Welcome to Your Health. I'm Rebecca Davis. In this program, the joy of losing weight and the sorrow of gaining it back. Plus, fat and aging, the great mysteries revealed. Also, anti-smoking campaigns, what works and what doesn't, and a comatose man and the novel he never wrote. But first, head injuries and the long-term effects of concussions. In the past, when athletes in contact sports have gotten a good knock on the head, it was considered no big deal. But specialists are growing more and more concerned about the long-term effects of concussions. The problem has been, how do you quickly tell if someone has just a bump on the head? And how do you tell when they really do have a concussion? Richard Knox has more.
Megan Garland knows that a concussion can be serious. That's why she's going to see Boston neurologist Francis Jensen.
So you're here because of headaches, right? So how old are you?
I'm 17.
17, okay.
Back in December, Garland had a nasty fall.
So I slipped on black ice, fell flat on my head.
So you had head injury?
Yeah. And I went to bed, woke up, and I just felt like the worst headache I've ever had in my life.
And the headaches didn't stop. Garland's had them for nearly 3 months now, sometimes accompanied by nausea and vomiting. And her mother says she's also been uncharacteristically irritable. Jensen tests Garland's strength and reflexes.
Let's just see you straighten your fingers out. Good. Excellent. Okay. Make a muscle. Don't let me pull. All right. Like this. Very good.
Doctors see lots of patients like Megan Garland. Connecticut neurologist Anthony Alessi says it's not at all unusual to see adolescents who've had repeated concussions. That's troubling because young brains are more susceptible to injury.
We know that the developing brain really needs time to do just that, develop. So any repeated head injury becomes an issue of concern.
It makes it important to figure out just when a kid has suffered a concussion or not. And that's where Dr. James Eckner comes in. He and his colleagues at the University of Michigan have developed a quick test to help diagnose concussions where many of them occur on the athletic field. They'll present preliminary results on the test this spring at a meeting of the American Academy of Neurology. Eckner's test measures reaction time, which is often impaired after a concussion. It's really simple. It's just a hockey puck on the end of a stick. The stick has regular markings.
The person being tested would be sitting down with their forearm resting on a table. We suspend the device so that their hand is around the hockey puck at the bottom of the device, and without warning, we drop it, and they just catch it as quickly as they can.
The place on the stick where they grabbed it tells the tester how fast they reacted. After a concussion, Eckner says the reaction time is 15% slower on average, about 30 milliseconds. There are computer programs that test reaction times, but it's not so easy to do that on a playing field, and many school systems are strapped for cash and can't afford the licensing fees. Eckner says his test has the advantage of being low-tech.
It's like the stethoscope compared to the echocardiogram. It doesn't give you quite as much information, but it's something you can put in your pocket and carry with you and use very easily.
The hockey puck on a stick test needs more work. Even if it holds up, Anthony Alessi, the Connecticut neurologist, says it's never going to be a standalone test to rule out a concussion.
We all want a simple, quick, easy test that's going to tell us exactly what to do, and that's just not the case.
Trained personnel will still need to assess an athlete's symptoms. But, Alessi says, reaction time tests might help, especially when players hide their symptoms so they can stay in the game. Once a young athlete's had a concussion, it's important to avoid another. So sometimes it's necessary to make a hard decision. That's the message that neurologist Francis Jensen wants to leave with Megan Garland, who's due to start lacrosse practice next month.
If you're going to be taking a sport that might put you at risk for head injury, that would probably be not a great thing.
Women's lacrosse is not exactly a contact sport. Still, Megan seems to agree that maybe it's not such a good idea to risk getting hit in the head with a stick. Richard Knox, NPR News.
Next week, we'll hear a story, also by Richard Knox, about the particularities of the teenage brain. Neuroscience can explain a lot of behavior that leaves many parents baffled. Here's an excerpt.
You think of them as these surly, rude, selfish people. Well, actually, that's the developmental stage they're at. They aren't yet at that place where they're thinking about or capable necessarily of thinking about the effects of their behavior on others.
We'll have the rest of that story next week. What secrets, what abilities does the comatose brain hold? One could not help but wonder about this when a few months ago, the story broke about a comatose man who was supposedly writing a book. His name is Rom Hooven, and he's Belgian. 20 years ago, doctors concluded that a car crash had left Mr. Hooven in a vegetative state. But then he suddenly gained international fame for supposedly revealing his innermost thoughts through a technique called facilitated communication. Well, now it looks like those initial reports were wrong. Hooven's doctor says a scientific test has shown his patient can't even answer the simplest of questions. John Hamilton has more.
Facilitated communication occurs when a so-called facilitator supports the hand or arm of an impaired person and helps them use a keyboard or other device. Lots of studies have found that the technique is unreliable. One way or another, the facilitator is communicating, not the impaired person. But Dr. Stephen Larez, the lead neurologist on Rom Hooven's case, sounded like a believer when he spoke with All Things Considered host Melissa Block. Here's Larez, who leads the coma science group at the University of Liège, describing the first time he tested his patient's ability to communicate through a facilitator.
Showing him different objects and asking him afterwards what I've been showing him. So the first word he communicated to me was the word key, my car keys, that I just showed him.
Larez now says he was uncomfortable with some of what he said in that interview. And since then, he's tested Hooven and some other patients more rigorously. A few days ago, Larez and his research team presented the results of those tests at a scientific meeting in the UK. Larez says they showed the patient an object or spoke a word. The facilitator was out of the room. Then the facilitator was brought back in to help the patient answer questions.
We presented three cases after traumatic brain injury to fail the test, and that was including Rom.
The man who was supposed to be writing a novel could not even identify an apple through facilitated communication. Larez says it's possible Hooven passed the earlier test with car keys, which took place years ago, because his facilitator had been in the room and saw the object. Larez says he tried repeatedly to confirm the result with Hooven's original facilitator, but the results were always inconclusive.
If you have answers like, I don't want to do the test, or you don't trust me, those kinds of answers, well, then you cannot say anything.
The recent tests were done with a different facilitator who was prepared to take part in the more rigorous experiment. Dr. Stephen Novella, a neurologist at Yale University, says he's not surprised by any of this.
Stephen Larez is a legitimate researcher and neurologist. I think he just wasn't familiar with facilitated communication, and that bit him in the behind.
Novella says Larez was trying to make an important point that many patients are misdiagnosed as being vegetative. But he says miraculous recoveries are extremely rare.
This is the story that always gets told on dramas, that some person's in a coma and they wake from their coma. But it's a very distorted view of reality. And unfortunately, the Rom Hooven case played right into that.
Novella says Hooven may well be conscious, but there's no evidence he's able to write a book. John Hamilton, NPR News.
And now, weight and aging. Regardless of your age, most people can see that growing older often means adding the pounds, even for those who are conscious of what and how much they eat. We'll take a look at how the age factor changes this tried and true notion. Don't eat more calories than your body can burn. But before we get to that story, let's consider why it's so hard at any age to keep weight off after losing it. Allison Aubrey begins this report on the streets of Manhattan, where she's surrounded by food vendors.
Looks like you've got hot peanuts.
Peanuts.
And what else? Almonds?
Almonds.
Wow, the smell is really good. You know how the smell of street food can make you hungry? Just the smell. Even if you didn't have much of an appetite. But what happens inside the brain when you see food? Well, I'm about to find out what happens in my brain. I'm at the Columbia University Medical Center, just outside the Neurological Institute, and I'm getting ready to have an MRI.
Okay, so Allison, this first scan is going to be a localizer scan. It's just going to give me a few rough images of your brain.
What Kogan and neuroscientist Joy Hirsch are doing here is pretty simple. They're going to put me in the MRI and watch my brain react to food that they show me. Joy Hirsch rolls in a cart filled with all kinds of foods. There's a bowl of nuts, crackers, slices of apples, red pepper, grapes, and broccoli. Nothing fancy here.
Nothing?
Right?
Oh, no. This is just ordinary garden variety cheese. Here,
Hershey's Kisses.
Now, I'd imagine the brain will respond to chocolate, right?
Oh, indeed.
The scanner will detect exactly which parts of my brain respond by measuring increased blood flow.
And your job is just to look at the food, appreciate it.
In their regular experiments, they'd also measure the amount of leptin in their subjects' blood because they want to understand the relationship between this hormone that helps regulate appetite and how it affects the brain's response to food.
Allison, are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
After a bunch of awful beeps that reminded me of a test of the emergency broadcast system, the food parade began. For about 20 minutes, the researcher showed me all the edible goodies.
And you will see a very specific circuit in your brain that's associated with the appreciation of food.
And the interesting part is that these circuits or networks of brain activity tend to vary given a person's weight status. You see, what Hirsch and her colleague Michael Rosenbaum have found in their research is that when they scan people who've been on diets, lost 10% of their body weight, and have depleted levels of the hormone leptin due to the weight loss, their brains tend to show an emotional pattern of response. There's more activity in areas related to reward seeking.
After you've lost weight, you have an increase in the emotional response to food, but a decrease in the activity of brain systems that might be more involved in restraint.
A combination that Rosenbaum says helps explain the yo-yo effect, when people repeatedly lose, then gain weight. What's fascinating about their research is what happens when they replenish levels of leptin in their subjects, basically giving them intramuscular injections of the hormone. They find that the brain response to food changes significantly. Hirsch says with restored leptin, her test subjects' brain responses looked something like mine.
Well, this is very cool. Very cool. This is your brain in action.
Analyzing the images of my brain response to food, Hirsch says she sees increased activity in areas of my parietal and frontal lobes.
This is the executive part of the brain. This is...
So I'm using executive function.
You are. I mean, in this case, I mean, you're responding like somebody who is in a what I call homeostatic state. This is your natural way of processing food.
Of course, this could change. It's just a snapshot in time. But it was fascinating to see that I didn't have a very emotional response. Hirsch says her research is a work in progress, but what she thinks it's showing is that our physiology tends to set the brain in one of two modes, the regain mode, nudging our emotional brains to seek food, or what she calls the retain mode, which helps us maintain a steady weight. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
I'm Patty Neiman. As we age, our appetites may not change, but that can mean weight gain. Just ask Shirley. We can't use her last name because of privacy issues at UCLA, where she's taking part in a study, but Shirley has something to say that might sound familiar.
Weight is a very hard thing to lose. It's easier to gain it than it is to lose it, and I probably have never been as heavy as I am now.
At 73 years old, Shirley says she is overweight, which is why when her doctor suggested she take part in a yoga study for seniors, she happily agreed. A few months later, she says, she saw big changes.
I had more endurance. I felt invigorated. When I left that class and I walked to my car, it was like the sun was shining and everything was terrific. So it made me feel very good.
And she lost weight. You've heard it all before. Exercise is even more important as we age because of the biological changes that happen to all of us. Dr. Cheryl Phillips is president of the American Geriatric Society.
Muscle mass, the amount of muscle we have in our body, decreases with age. So if you look at a woman who is 70 years old and compare her to what her body was like at 25 years of age, even though the weight may be exactly the same, she had more percentage of muscle in her body when she was 25 than she does when she's 70.
When younger muscle cells get damaged, they're quickly repaired. That's not the case with older muscles, according to UCLA geriatrician Dr. Jonathan Wanagot.
We don't know why muscles become smaller and weaker as we get older. There's a lot of different theories that have looked at this. I think one of the ones that's become increasingly interesting and popular is the idea that the stem cells within the muscle are not able to respond to damage or to aging the way that they did when we were younger.
And if damaged muscle cells aren't repaired, they sort of whittle away and die, says Wanigat. So not only do we lose muscle cells as we age, the cells we're left with are sort of worn out. Cheryl Phillips.
And if you think of muscles as being the energy powerhouse of our body, that's where most of the calories are burned. That's also when we talk about metabolism. What we're really talking about is how efficiently those powerhouse cells, the muscle cells of our body, burn the energy we bring in, and we know that energy as calories.
And if you keep your caloric intake exactly the same, says Phillips, those unburned calories end up as fat. And that's where exercise comes in. UCLA's Wanigat says countless studies have shown exercise, even among individuals in their 80s, works.
We know that exercise actually helps the muscle cells become bigger. And so there is an increase in the size of the muscles that happens with exercise, even in older individuals. But we also know that it makes the muscles stronger sort of separately from that increase in size.
At UCLA, geriatrician Dr. Gail Greendale has just started another yoga study with seniors to try to figure out what yoga poses work best for the older body.
What are the muscle and joint forces generated by each yoga pose? And will these muscle and joint forces be strong enough to be a training stimulus, that is to say, make people stronger?
Without injury, which is especially important due to another phenomenon of aging. Greendale says the immune system can get out of whack, turning on an inflammatory response when there's no bacteria or virus to kill, or keeping it on long after the body's invaders have left.
An inflammatory cell is there to destroy another cell. So if it's on and there's no invader to destroy, it will damage your own cells. Wherever the inflammation is going on, it can actually damage the cells of that part of the body,
causing more problems to aging joints. Greendale's yoga study is getting underway now. Patty Namond, NPR News.
While it may be obvious that if you want to lose weight, you have to eat less, when it comes to smoking, the process of quitting can be a bit more complicated. Today, there's still some 46 million smokers in the U.S., but there is an even larger group of ex-smokers. NPR's Brenda Wilson reports on how anti-smoking efforts have evolved over the decades.
It's been nearly half a century since U.S. Surgeon General Luther Terry declared that smoking had been linked to lung cancer and was hazardous to health. Smoking in the United States has been on the decline ever since.
Physicians started telling their patients about the dangers of tobacco use and letting them know that they should quit smoking.
Dr. Anne Malarche of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says smoke-free policies were mainly a patchwork in the early years after the Surgeon General's report. Warnings were placed on cigarette packets, radio and television cigarette ads were banned. Malarche says people who wanted to quit were left to their own devices.
Avoiding places where they typically smoked, avoiding situations where they wanted to have a cigarette, removing all tobacco products from their house, perhaps avoiding other smokers for a while.
For millions and millions of Americans, such strategies worked and they quit. Then in 1984, the first nicotine gum became available by prescription as a way to help more people quit. A bigger nudge came in 1994 when California became the first state to outlaw smoking in all restaurants and bars. As other states followed suit and smoking became less socially acceptable, the smoking rate fell to where it is today, 20%. John Hughes, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Vermont, works with people who have not been moved by these changes.
Well, public health messages such as the media and increasing taxes and worksite restrictions are very important in motivating people to quit, but they don't help them quit.
Especially the hardcore smokers, he says.
There are some people that you can motivate and motivate and motivate, and they can't quit.
And for such people, he says, medications can help. There's the nicotine gum and patches, which can now be bought over the counter. There are a total of 7 medications. Most are nicotine substitutes, but 2 are drugs that ease cravings. People can also get one-on-one counseling, call quit lines, or join a support group. Combined with medication, Hughes says, these methods are much more effective than trying to quit cold turkey. But most people don't avail themselves of drugs or counseling. Cost is a barrier, but the bigger reason, Hughes says, is that people think they ought to be able to quit on their own.
I think it's because, you know, if you have drug abuse and you get over to your own, you don't tell anybody about it. But if you quit smoking, if there's a conversation on smoking, you brag and tell about it. So I think people hear about all the people who are fortunate enough to be able to do it on their own and don't hear about the people that are struggling.
But Simon Chapman at the University of Sydney in Australia says quitting smoking has become too medicalized.
The subtext of that is if you try to do it alone, you're unlikely to succeed.
Both Chapman and Hughes have conducted research that was funded by pharmaceutical companies. Even so, Chapman fears the balance in smoking control tilts towards the drug industry.
My objection is to the megaphoning, the drowning out effect of the hugely resourced messages which are going out to the community, which are saying, if you want to quit, don't try to do it alone.
It's important to remember, he says, that 75% of the people who quit did do it on their own without any help. But then there's the 25% who don't. Brenda Wilson, NPR News.
And that's all for Your Health. If you'd like to hear more health and science reporting, visit our website, npr.org/health or npr.org/science. And please listen in again next week for more of the best from the Health Desk here at NPR. I'm Rebecca Davis.